from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. The grisly discoveries of bodies in wells in the Calaveras County area are just one of the headlines in the Stockton area, and we'll take a look at that, as well as other stories there with Michael Fitzgerald. He is a columnist with the Stockton Record and a visitor with Insight. Welcome back.
Good morning, David.
So the top news just came out was that there may be a third well that was discovered with bodies in it?
Yes. Shermantine, the killer on death row, has gone from being completely uncooperative to singing like a canary. Mm-hmm. And clearly what changed things is that his partner in crime, Herzog, hung himself in his house trailer when it appeared that Shermantine was going to cooperate with law enforcement. Herzog's release was actually one of the factors that precipitated this incredible story. It really steamed Shermantine that he was sitting on death row, condemned, confined, and unhappy, mm-hmm. while Herzog, who was in on everything that they did, and according to Shermantine was the perpetrator, mm-hmm. was the alpha male, skated and was actually paroled. Mm-hmm. Basically, on his sentence was overturned on a technicality. The court ruled that his confession was coerced and he wasn't given access to a lawyer. By the way, I read the Herzog interrogations. I don't find coercion there. I thought the courts were very legalistic. But the funny thing is that it all worked out for the best. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about that statement. The release of a serial killer or a once convicted serial killer, we have to bear in mind that Herzog's convictions were overturned, appears to be the worst outcome of which a criminal justice system is capable. Mm-hmm. messing up doesn't get much worse than that.
Right.
However, when Herzog got out, Shermantine was so angry that he began to entertain, it allowed the people who were trying to manipulate him into cooperation to a wedge between him and Herzog. And so pretty soon they found out what was really eating at Shermantine. And that was, of course, that he had reparations to pay, restitution, I should say. And that any money you put in the Shermantine commissary fund was immediately seized by the state and put down towards the restitution.
And we should say, and we talked about this at length last week, that Leonard Padilla, the local bounty hunter, came through with a chunk of money, which I guess he just wrote the first check for today. But the upshot is now what's just happened is that they found another well, and that this comes from Shermantine after he got this first check. Now he's saying there's another well. He's still talking about, now he's talking about 30 bodies potentially?
Yes. And that puts Herzog and Shermantine right up there in Ted Bundy territory, mm-hmm. as
or Juan Corona,
one of America's most notorious serial killers. And it was going on in our own backyard all this time. Mm-hmm. What a nightmare.
Well, compared to that, some of these other things may not seem so bad, but last time you were here in January, about a month ago, we were talking about the city of Stockton, pretty bad shape. And since then, we've discovered that a lot of the department heads quit, the CFO of the city quit. What's going on?
Well, the city of Stockton never made a lot of money because it sits in the San Joaquin Valley, and the San Joaquin Valley has a low-wage agrarian economy. People there make less money. Government there collects fewer tax dollars. It can do less. Only Stockton pretended that it was in Huntington Beach, and it wrote all of its public employees giant checks anyway. Mm-hmm. So the combination of the recession and their own fiscal foolishness, all of a sudden they were looking at 10 toes over the edge of municipal bankruptcy, and they still are. It's a very touch-and-go situation there. So what do you do? City government has very few capital costs. Most of city government's costs are people costs, mm-hmm. the cost of employees. You want to save money, you got to cut there. So they laid off. I mean, they cut to the bone, they cut into the bone, they cut out the marrow and boiled it into soup. They had virtually nowhere to go except to cut the compensation, and that is they cracked open existing contracts, not just open contracts, and they unilaterally imposed cuts.
And last time you were here, we talked about the police, and that
yes.
was all going on.
And they're suing the city to overturn that.
We can go back to that, but carry on.
And so, as you know from being in Sacramento and being familiar with pensions of public employees, A public employee's retirement is based on their last several years of service. Mm-hmm. So you get 90% of your last several years. And all these department heads were looking at cuts that would permanently affect their pensions. So every department head in the city of Stockton, save one, retired and just left. And so what happened, what's going on in the city of Stockton right now is that the city manager, the deputy city, a couple deputy city managers have taken over all of these departments. They're running redevelopment. They're running the community development department. They were running the municipal utilities department. Basically, you name the department, and some poor slug is running it, plus several others. Mm-hmm. They're working from 8 a.m. until midnight. There are stories of burnout. There are stories of these guys screaming at their subordinates. And yes, one of the new team members that was hired, a woman named Susan Mayer, she was the CFO of Vallejo when it went through bankruptcy. Oh. And she was brought aboard, and the spin was only a person who's gone through bankruptcy can help us best to avert it. But I think what they didn't want to say was, if we have to do it, she can help us do it and do it right. Uh-huh. She quit, and she quit last week with 1 week's notice and a very terse statement, see you later, eat a potato, and she was out the door.
Wow. And no more details on that? Or what's the scuttlebutt on why that
nothing
happened?
That,
I mean, that's very, very short tenure.
Nothing I can get people to say. Well, she was there for about a year, and what she found was that Stockton's books were full of hanky-panky. There's something called an inter-fund transfer, which is this department loans to that department, and then that department can loan over to that department, and you rob Peter to pay Paul, and Paul to pay Peter, until neither Peter nor Paul know what's going on, and Peter's slipping quietly out of town. Mm-hmm. And so she actually spent a year unraveling this Byzantine semi-cooking of Stockton's books and allowed the city to put those rooms of its fiscal house in order. But again, there are staff cuts to her department. There's this looming specter of a possible bankruptcy. There's all this drama with the public employee unions. There's litigation. There's angst. So finally, it appears that she just had a combination of burnout, and there may have been some philosophical disagreements as well. I think I can't get this on the record, but what I think I'm hearing is that she advocated bankruptcy. She wants Stockton to take the plunge and get it over with. Mm-hmm. But the council feels that bankruptcy is not in the city's interest and wants to avert it if at all possible.
Speaking with Michael Fitzgerald of the Stockton Record about goings on down there, there is a quarterly report coming up at the end of this month, which seems rather early for a quarterly report. I'm assuming we're talking
Q4. A city that declares a fiscal emergency and under the color of law then makes unilateral cuts to its workforce because it's a so in other words, you write a contract with your police, with your fire, with the other bargaining units, and it says, okay, here's your contract, unless there's a fiscal emergency. Mm-hmm. So then if they declare a fiscal emergency, supposedly they claim they have the legal right, the police dispute that, to impose these cuts unilaterally. But then the law obliges you to issue quarterly reports. And there's one coming out in the last day of February, and we will see how Stockton is doing and whether it is backing away from the brink or, as I suspect, whether it's edging even closer.
Yeah, because you're living your economy down there. I mean, we're having a hard time up here, but the economy in Stockton is as you said, more agrarian. And you also did a lot of redevelopment, as we talked about last time, a lot of infrastructure improvements.
And we have staggering debt. Mm-hmm. That was another thing. The city spent like that girl on the freecreditscore.com commercial where, you know, she gets her dad's credit card and then has a pizza party for everybody in the dorm. And they have staggering debt. And they have a $544 million employee retiree issue, and they haven't put $1 down on it. What were you saying, though? I wanted to go back to another point that you were making about the city's fiscal problem. Well, anyway, go ahead.
Well, and we are short on time. If you think of it, let me know. But One more deficit that we're facing in California in general is water.
Yes.
And there's been a move afoot for a long time to drain Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, which was sort of an equivalent of Yosemite Valley, or
yes,
according to John Muir, even better, which is the main source for water for San Francisco. It also affects Stockton.
Yeah, thank you for that. Nobody thinks about that. There's a persistent movement to drain Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. John Muir called it the second Yosemite, and to restore it to its pristine beauty. It was a natural, it was a World Heritage Site. It should never, it was very rash of Congress to allow that to be flipped. But what happened was San Francisco was traumatized from the fire that followed the great quake of 06, and they just didn't want to run short of water ever again. Mm-hmm. However, there are those now that say that that never should have been done, that Hetch Hetchy should be drained, that San Francisco has 9 reservoirs that virtually fill all of its water needs, so why not restore this magnificent valley and have a second Yosemite? The Sierra Club, for instance, still supports draining Hetch Hetchy, as do other organizations. As recently, curiously, did Congressman Dan Lundgren, who's a Republican and never met a dam he didn't like.
Yeah, right. He's Mr. Auburn Dam.
Well, except that it's so fun to needle San Francisco if you're a Republican legislator, isn't it? He is actually asking the Secretary of the Interior to see if they're in violation of their original contract with Congress. They were supposed to use every water source first, only then Hetch Hetchy. But the point that I wanted to make is that this issue is seen as, well, we should stay with the status quo or we should drain Hetch Hetchy. But nobody thinks about the Delta. The Delta is a natural wonder in its own right. It's the largest estuary in the Western Americas, all the way to the tip of Chile. And no one is thinking about the impact of Hetch Hetchy yes or Hetch Hetchy no on the Delta. Well, Hetch Hetchy yes means that they are diverting the Tuolumne River watershed away from the Delta. And what that does is it reduces, it diminishes the amount of fresh Sierra snowmelt running through the Delta. So while you have a clean American river up here, we have a dirty San Joaquin down there because of all the diversions that take place on that river and its tributaries. So, I mean, here's a thought. How about letting a river run from right out the gates at its watershed all the way down the riverbed through the Delta, if not to the sea? And San Francisco could build a reservoir closer to the city and divert its water from some point in the Delta. That would be so good for the riverine environment. It'd be good for the fishies. It'd be good for the animals along those rivers. It'd be good for the communities along the rivers who would get somewhat fresher water and pay reduced wastewater charges. There'd be less pollution. That'd help Stockton redevelopment at its waterfront by making the water more alluring. And it would be better even for San Francisco in that the Delta flows out through the Suisun Bay into the San Francisco Bay. So there'd be a healthier bay as well. Of course, they don't want to do it because they want to reach up almost to the snowpack to get the freshest water possible. And that's understandable. But they're doing it. And so that's hence my point, that any ecological impact against Hetch Hetchy is also an impact against the Delta. And that should be remembered and should be a part of the equation.
All right. Well, Michael Fitzgerald, as always, great to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
We have we will have some links to some of Michael's work on our website, capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Coming up, innovation and the future of the Sacramento region's economy. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. As anyone who uses a computer or a smartphone knows, technology is key in the modern economy, and there are few places where it is as important as in California. After all, it was invented here. But what about Sacramento? Where does our region fit into that equation? My next guests are here to talk about Innovate, a one-day event Thursday at the Community Center Theater in Sacramento that is being put on by SARTA, the Sacramento Area Regional Technology Alliance, along with the Sacramento Metro Chamber. Meg Arnold is CEO of Sarta. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And also here is Bill Mueller, who's with Valley Vision, an area nonprofit. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks, David.
Before we start talking about what kind of technology jobs can be brought here, what kind of technology jobs do we already have in Sacramento area?
Well, we're about to publish a map of technology companies in the Sacramento region, first time it's been done. It's the first mostly comprehensive assessment of the technology sector in the region for a number of years. And I think we'll be surprised to see that there are more than 450 tech companies in our region.
Wow.
Yes, ranging from medical device technology companies to clean technology companies that the region's been focused on really significantly over the last few years, to software developers, app developers, electronic component manufacturers, the big anchor tenants, so to speak, of Intel, HP, and Aerojet out in Rancho Cordova.
And those are the two, HP and Intel are obviously the two that everybody thinks about. But sort of the nature of a lot of technology innovation is that is done by small companies.
The vast majority of the 450 plus on our list are indeed very small companies. The reason that the tech sector has potential for our region and is an increasingly large component of a large regional economic development plan project called the Next Economy is that tech companies, when they start to add jobs, they can scale them very rapidly. And so in addition, the jobs they add are generally knowledge-based and high-value employment opportunities that can bring wealth not to just the employees in the region, but to the region more generally.
And sorry, Bill Mueller.
And David, as a former Intel employee, one of the things I know is that many of the small companies actually have roots in Intel, that employees that used to work there that have reached a turning point in their careers have gone off and created their own firms. So it's important to have both the small employers, of course, in the Sacramento region, as in across the United States, over 90% of the employers have 20 or few in the Sacramento region. But we also need those large employers because they're sort of the offer up the employees that are going to create the next breakthrough innovations.
Which does raise the question, and it comes up all the time, and when discussing these things, is jobs, particularly right now. Do we have a local university system and a local educational environment that does provide people to do these jobs, or do we bring a lot of people from outside of Sacramento?
Our university systems do a fantastic job, both at the community college level and the Sac State and the UC Davis level, of producing graduates across the spectrum from technical jobs up through, you know, postdoctoral graduate degree requiring employment opportunities. For example, at UC Davis, a large number of engineers that graduate on an annual basis, many of which are able to stay in the region, but many of which as well find employment elsewhere. And so one of the opportunities that I think we have as a region is to make sure that for those who wish to stay, there are sufficient opportunities here that they're well matched with so that they can not just come and stay here for their education, but make their homes here as well.
We're talking about innovation in Sacramento and the future of our innovation economy and our high-tech economy. Is there an exchange between existing companies and those universities? I mean, is there a back and forth? Are there people who teach at the universities who work at some of these companies or who are some of these innovators?
Absolutely. I think I'd point to Dr. Raju Pandey at Synapsense, which was actually founded by one of the alumni from Intel that Bill referenced earlier. Dr. Pandey is a full faculty member at UC Davis. He was the inventor of the technology at Synapsense. They just raised another $16 million of funding in 2011.
And what do they make?
They make a wireless sensor networking platform, and they're based out in Folsom, and they can help their clients, which are largely companies that run data centers, to be much more efficient, energy efficient in the energy that they use to cool the server banks that are in the data centers. Hugely positive return on investment within the first year of implementing this technology. So Dr. Pandey, in terms of the exchange back and forth between the private sector and the universities, he remains on campus. He teaches on campus. He's also chief technology officer for Synapsense. He's teaching a really interesting course this year on campus, a design course for his, I think it's his senior level undergraduates. And he's very actively bringing in guest speakers every week, I think it's twice a week, from the private sector in different areas of starting and running a technology business to really provide these students with direct, you know, been there, done that experience from these people's individual perspectives.
We're talking about innovation and technology in the Sacramento area with Megan Arnold of SARTA and Bill Mueller of Valley Vision. Bill, Valley Vision also just recently had a little breakthrough with broadband, right? That's mm-hmm. And that's part of this whole mix, too. And that's sort of where the rubber meets the information highway, as it were.
Absolutely. And the state of California has recognized that regions are very important units of economic change. So cities and counties group together across California. In fact, California really is sort of a nation state where regions are sort of occupying a really special role. And the state is investing in regions, providing money for a public-private partnership to help identify where there are gaps in the digital highway and where we ought to shore up those gaps in order to make sure that everyone in the community has high-speed access, whether it's wireless or wireland. And this is happening across California, but it is really important if we're going to build the 21st century infrastructure. We have to have the digital pipes going everywhere to support the high-tech companies that Meg is supporting, but also our public safety and our emergency warning systems and education, and to support those early stage entrepreneurs that can set up shop anywhere and need those really robust global networks to be able to exchange and create new products and services.
And Valley Vision does that sort of across many different areas, many different fields, right?
Yeah, yes. In fact, one of the roles that we play is a bit of an action tank. So we look for those areas in the region.
An action tank as opposed to a think tank.
An action tank.
Okay, I've never heard that expression before. I like that.
So a think tank is essentially a group that does really great academic research, but generally it goes on a shelf where it's meant to edify. Valley Vision provides sort of action-based research, and then we do something about it. So we have very skilled researchers, but also very trained project managers, and we work on things like broadband access and economic development and healthcare access and improving even food access. Food security is a big issue, and it requires sort of a systemic approach. So we pull people in groups together to address those regional problems.
That's Bill Mueller of Valley Vision. Also, here's Meg Arnold of SARTA, and we're going to have to finish pretty soon, but we are talking about Innovate, which is going to be at the Community Center on Thursday in Sacramento. What's that in a nutshell? What's going to happen that day?
It's at the Hyatt Regency.
Oh, sorry.
No
Hyatt
worries.
Regency, right next door.
Hyatt Regency, lunchtime on Thursday. It's a partnership between, as you said at the beginning, SARTA and the Sacramento Metro Chamber with a focus on advancing our innovation economy. And so we have a keynote speaker, Tim Williamson, of Idea Village in New Orleans, mm-hmm. Who has been instrumental in assembling the resources that his city has needed to become recognized as Inc. Magazine or Inc.com's coolest startup city in America.
New Orleans,
which was not a designation that I was aware was available, but it is a very cool designation to have.
It is, and it's not one that one would immediately think of New Orleans.
It is not. And so Idea Village, Tim Williamson's perspective with Idea Village is really about how both pre and post Katrina, he and a group of like-minded folks in the New Orleans region have really worked together to bring the resources that technology and startup companies and entrepreneurs in general need to be successful in that region. So he's going to come and share that learning with us and really challenge our region to step up on our own behalf. And that's very much in line with what the Next Economy Project is seeking to do through the first half of this year, which is essentially for us collectively to define and set up an action plan to create our next economy for our region. We've been through a terrible period of economic shock and upheaval. There are some things that need to be realigned, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so through Next Economy, we're hoping to do that. Tim Williamson's input is really directly in line with that effort. And as well, we're celebrating some of our technology companies in the region and the successes that they've had here in Sacramento.
Yeah, so you had Mark Otero.
We'll have Mark Otero on Thursday. He is General manager for BioWare Social, which is a division of Electronic Arts. Mm-hmm. He previously was CEO at Click Nation. Right. They were acquired by EA back in December of last year. We'll also have Pam Marone, who is the co-founder and CEO at Marone Bio Innovations, which is based in Davis. They develop natural biopesticides. This is her second company that she started in the Davis region, and she's raised $42 million for Marone Bio Innovations in the last few years. And we'll have Yatish Mishra, who is a CEO and co-founder at Raging Wire Enterprise Solutions. And they're a very large data center operator out in Natomas. They're the largest one in California today, and they'll soon be in the top 10 in the country in terms of their floor space size.
Well, that should be a real interesting a time on Thursday. Great. At the Hyatt. And we will have a link to that on our website at capradio.org/insight. Thanks so much for coming in. Meg Arnold of Sarta and Bill Mueller of Valley Vision. And good luck.
Thanks
so much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the first English language biography of Charles Munch. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news with our senior editor, Alan Ray. What's up, Alan?
Well, good morning, David. Sometimes the good news is the bad news, and that would be the weather news we've had here this year. A mild winter, warm for the most part, maybe 75 degrees by tomorrow. The upside is that there's been a low incidence of flu this year, and they say that's because it's been warmer. Influenza virus prefers to thrive in colder climates. And the other side of that is that allergies have increased substantially because, again, it's been warm. We've had more pollen and a lot of stuff in the air.
Yes, we're noticing that.
Yeah. Now, you have a cell phone, right?
Yes.
Well, bear this out. Researchers at the University of Maryland's Robert H. Smith School of Business say they have found that cell phone users are less likely to volunteer for community service. Cell phone users were found to be less persistent in solving word problems, even they knew the answers would translate to monetary donation to charity. The authors cited some previous research in explaining a cause they think of their findings. They say the cell phone directly evokes feelings of connectivity to others, thereby fulfilling the basic human need to belong. So I'm connected to you. I don't need to give anything to you.
Okay.
And one last thing going on today. We're coming to crunch time for the new arena for the Kings, or as supporters like to call it, the entertainment and sports venue. A lot of big numbers being thrown around today, and Mayor Kevin Johnson has an 11 o'clock news conference to talk about that. And some other stuff, too. Those stories and more coming up beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
All right. Well, we'll be listening. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
Charles Munch conducted the Boston Symphony for more than two decades, and during that time made a string of very famous recordings of classical music for RCA Records. My next guest, Dee Kern Holloman, is a UC Davis music professor who has written the first English language biography of Munch, who was born in France. And he joins me in the studio. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, David. Nice to be here.
What prompted you undertaking this biography of somebody who is a known name but not up there, the top tier perhaps?
Well, the principal reason is that he figures as a kind of a villain in my previous book because when the Paris Conservatory Orchestra after the war had to find its way, Munch was much more interested in achieving his international career. He was no longer a young man; he had a few decades left. So he wanted to leave Paris, and Paris didn't want him to leave. The other reason is that in 1968, when I was a conducting student and a music history student at Duke University, we went off to hear the new Orchestre de Paris under Charles Munch, which was his last appointment. And he conducted Berlioz and Ravel and Samuel Barber that night, and the next day he died in Richmond. So I happened to have been at his last concert, and that's Wade. And he was a model for me as a young conductor. So it weighed heavily, and I thought someday I want to write about this man.
And why isn't he as well known as von Karajan or Bernstein or Carl Böhm?
Well, for two different reasons. One is that he was a very modest man. He was a sober, quiet individual, sober in a philosophical way, a quiet man, and not especially interested in those kinds of questions. Additionally, his wife died very in the 50s, and he had no children. So there was really nobody to create the Munch legend, whereas Bernstein and Carrion in particular left behind large public relations companies and enterprises. And, you know, every moment of their last several years was preserved on tape or on video. Mm-hmm. And Toscanini had a family of hagiographers. So Munch simply didn't have somebody to come along behind him and do all of that. That said, the discography is remarkable. People don't understand how much music they know because of those RCA recordings from the early stereo days. Hmm. The entire French repertoire, Mendelssohn, Brahms, like that.
And so it was because he went in and performed or conducted those pieces that they became known to the general public? They weren't well known before that?
Oh, sure. For one thing, when he first started conducting, the French composer Roussel said, won't you help me make a work of my ballet, an orchestral work of my ballet, Bacchus and Ariadne? And that's a famous work now. Munch was the brain behind, the musician brain behind the Berlioz revival in the 50s and 60s. The French composer Dutilleux, and then the whole French repertoire, César Franck and like that. He was one of two major French conductors, the other one being Pierre Monteux, practicing in the United States. And, you know, after the war, people didn't much want to have a lot to do with German conductors. And so the two French conductors had carte blanche to make a go of it.
Well, let's listen to a little piece that this is Charles Munch conducting the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz, sorry. I'm speaking with D. Kern Holloman, who just wrote the first English language biography of conductor Charles Munch. And you're conducting.
Either way, actually. There's a wonderful story about that excerpt just there, which is that this is the first movement he rehearsed with the new Orchestre de Paris in 1967. And because he had come back from retirement to do this, this is on television and highly photographed, and André Malraux, the Minister of Arts, was there, and so on and so on. And Munch looks out while the fiddle players are having some difficulty with the opening event in this movement, and he says, "What kind of violins do you have?" And they held up their violins. He said, "Because in Boston we had 12 Stradivarius. Do you have Stradivarius?" And they all look and they nod negatively, and he said, "Ah, well, we'll do the best we can anyway." So about these stereo recordings. So the Damnation of Faust in 1953-54, someplace in there, was the very first classical music recording where they actually tried to do stereo. It was not published in stereo at the beginning, but they double-taped it. They taped it in mono upstairs and downstairs for the Cognoscenti. They were trying the stereophonic recording system for the first time, and that turned into RCA Living Stereo.
So when they did that, they recorded mono in two different places because you would be getting a different sound in those two different places, but they would still be synced up?
No. They had a complete mono recording studio on upstairs in Symphony Hall, and downstairs they had a second setup with the extra microphone where they were actually experimenting with how they might do this. This is before there was any widely available hardware for the public, commercial hardware, to actually play it back. They didn't know what they were going to sell when it was over. They just wanted to make the sound work.
Oh, okay. And then were those released much later?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then quite quickly they were doing everything in stereo. But it was just five people at RCA and three orchestras, and so it took a while to get going.
What is the overarching characteristic of a great, not just a good conductor, but a great conductor?
Well, what I argue in this book is I think a great conductor has to be most interested in music at the moment. At the moment that in live performance, even more than in recording, he has to be rebuilding the piece from scratch. This is a period where everybody where the notion of fidelity to the score was kicking in, and Toscanini kept saying you have to be faithful to the score. I don't think that Munch was actually faithful to the printed score. I think he had committed the printed score to memory decades before. And when you watch him work, there's a lot of video now, when you watch him work, what you see is this man who knew every nuance of how Brahms first goes, rebuilding it in his mind and then conveying it to the musicians so that this piece that, after all, the Boston Symphony had played Brahms first 400, 500, 600 times under Charles Munch, make it new again, make it interesting again, make it of the moment. And he was a genius at that, I think one of the best.
I'm speaking with D. Kern Holloman, who just wrote the first book in the English language of Charles Munch. Biographies often end up being more interesting to a larger audience if there's some personal aspects of the person. Do you talk much about his life beyond music, or do you focus pretty much on music?
Oh, sure.
Because it makes it sound like he's not so much.
One of the things that's fascinating about this man is that first he led the Orchestre de Paris through the occupation in Paris. And therefore, he was dealing with the Nazi authorities all the time. He was binational. He spoke both German and French from the beginning. And that's a fascinating story. A second fascinating story is the fact that his marriage was a complex one. He had lots of girlfriends, and one of them's still alive, but two of them are very significant sources for this book. So you get a certain amount of... how shall I put it, romance in the book. And I think also you get a great deal of what it was like to try to reconcile the German and French cultures, Beethoven and Brahms and Bach. The Munches go back to Bach. The Munches are interrelated by family with the Schweitzers and people in the governing, also with Jean-Paul Sartre. So they're... the cream of the crop, intellectually, fiscally, very, very wealthy people. Munch married the Nestle estate, so he had all the Nestle money. He could buy anything he wanted. He had paintings and etchings and little statues worth gazillions of francs. So it's a fascinating story, quite apart from Berlioz and Beethoven and Brahms, I think.
Well, the book is Charles Munch. Munch, say it for me, would you please?
Either way, he says Charles Munch. His friends called him Shari for Charlie. But in Leipzig, where he began, he was called Karl Munch. So you're perfectly right.
Okay, well, I'll just wander all over the place. But D. Kern Holloman, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Good luck with the book. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Sea of Bees. Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. You're also listening to Sea of Bees, which is the nom de groove of one Julianne Baeziger, who also goes by Julianne B. She is the leader of this Sacramento-based band, which is making waves around the country. She is here to preview some songs from her new album, which is finished but won't be released until May. Julianne B., welcome.
Hi, Mr. D. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Pleasure. And also here is John Bacigalupi, a longtime musician and music producer and promoter and record label head and studio owner and magazine publisher and all sorts of things, right?
Good to see you again, Dave.
You too. The new album is your second. The first was recorded came out in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So you've had a good little breather there, except what have you been doing all that time?
My God, a lot of things. We've been just touring a lot. I came back from the European tour, went straight into recording as soon as I got home. And then after that, we just finished, we're putting it out with Heavenly Records in UK. And then we made new friends with Team Love Records on the East Coast, so we're going to put it out with them in the US. And So now we're just prepping for the European tours right now and the festivals and America. And it's been a whirlwind. It's been loads of fun, though.
It sounds like it, yeah. Was this? I remember when the album came out, and there was a lot of buzz, no pun intended, on the first album. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, it was unexpected. Well, really unexpected. John and I worked really hard, though, you know, and I think we put a lot of heart and soul in it. And yeah, it's just very unexpected, though.
Well, let's listen to a little bit. This is a song called Take from the new album, and the new album is going to be called
Orange Farben. It's German for the killer orange.
Okay. Let's listen to a little bit of Sea of Bees.
Break. Or stroke down your back. Make you feel power. Or feel to.
That's Sea of Bees, who is my guest today, Julianne B. You're still enjoying hearing this stuff, right? I mean, even after having spent so much time with it in the studio.
Oh yeah, it's just a part of me. You know, you always got to come back to the beginning, and I don't know. I find it. You take a break, and then it's, you know, you listen to it again, and it's refreshing, you know.
How long did it take to record the album?
About 2 months, John, 3 months.
Yeah, yeah. Probably even a little bit more with mixing and yeah. everything. And
Julianne, when you write a song, because you also do the songs, we have a recording of you doing a song solo coming up. But when you write a song, and then you go into the studio with John and with musicians,
yeah.
Do you have an idea when you go in of how you want it to sound, or is it sort of a voyage of discovery?
Kind of both. Usually I'll write the song, you know, and I'll have an idea that I want to try out, you know, and I'll give it a go. I'll experiment a little bit. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we bring in like my friends to record and stuff, I usually have an idea set for them. I don't like to just put them on the spot. Mm-hmm. But
so
usually
do you demo
with me.
It or do you just have an idea?
Usually it's just an idea. I used to demo it, but
this record, we're just on such a tight deadline.
Yeah.
A lot of it was kind of worked out in the studio kind of as we're going along.
Well, that's
and most of it's Jules playing 80% of the music is her. There's not a lot of other musicians on this record.
Is that different than the first?
The first record had well, you didn't play any drums on the first record.
No.
That was all James Neal.
Yeah, but this one
on this one, he played a little bit, but Jules played a fair amount of the drums on this record as well.
Really? Okay. That's why you were liking the drums in the last the previous track.
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to a song we just recorded of Jules by herself, and this song is called.
This song's called Gone. Yeah. Oh, you
truly, oh, how wonderful you are to me. Oh, no, you will pick up all your teeth off the floor.
That's Julianne Benziger of Sea of Bees from the forthcoming album. It's quite a different sound when you're playing by yourself than it is when you've added all the other flavors.
Yeah, it's definitely like it's very intimate, huh? Like,
do you prefer one or the other?
Not really. I kind of enjoy both. Like, I enjoy creating the big sound. And mm-hmm. and all the other textures when it comes to the album. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to me by myself stripped down, I find it like, I don't know, yeah, just very one-on-one, very pure, very clean.
And audiences like that too, don't they?
Yeah, they like both, I think. Some people don't. Some people like the big thing, and some people are very pick. I mean, I'm sure about this album, people have a lot to say, like, oh, it doesn't sound like the other album. Or, mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just where I'm at in my life right now. I think it was a whole journal of just about somebody I loved or whom I love, you know. And I just wanted to put it out there, and I was never trying to be different or mm-hmm. just being myself and doing what I like, you know.
And that difference came as a result of going out and playing a lot, or did it come as a result of things that you heard?
I think it's a mixture of both, like. You, when you're on tour, you listen to a lot of different music. You start getting inspired by other people without even thinking about it too hard. Mm. And it just comes in you, and you start putting it out there yourself. And you're like, wow, that's kind of like from this person, or, you know. But yeah, it's kind of from both, I think.
And you are, the album's coming out in May. You're getting ready to go on tour. Are you going to tour in Europe first?
Yeah, first Europe, and then we'll come home for a bit, and then we have to pan out the other things, John. Like,
you've got South by Southwest coming up too. Yeah. Before Europe, there's four or five shows there with Patagon, you and Amber,
and that's the middle of March.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And you're gonna have a lot of company from Sacramento down in Austin this year. It sounds like.
Oh hell yeah!
Lots of local bands. Yeah. Death Grips are going. Ganglions are going. Right?
Dude, Sacramento. I don't know. People even in London are like, so what's the deal with Sacramento? I'm like,
really?
People are just doing what they love, I think, and they're not thinking too hard about it, you know? They're just doing it.
And that's recognized as something unique in other places?
I think so, yeah, because it is pretty rare. Now that I've gotten to see a lot of different places, it's very rare. There's not like a little, you know, we have like a posse here, and people are starting to see that, I think, and... I don't want to sound cheesy, but.
Well, that's great, though. And you are definitely one of the prime representatives of Sea of Bees, Julianne.
Shucks.
Good luck with the album. Good luck with South by Southwest and the tour. And we're actually going to go out with a song from the album. This is Broke, Sea of Bees. Thanks for coming. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Today's associate producer was Sarah Jung. Our technical director is Mark Jones. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.